With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.
Andrew Lowenthal is a writer and consultant focused on digital authoritarianism. He manages the Network Effects Substack, writes for Racket and Public, and directs the digital civil liberty startup Libernet.org. He's also a Brownstone Institute fellow. Andrew coordinated the Westminster Declaration, and that might trigger a memory because we were talking with him about that back in November last year. So Andrew Lowenthal is with us again. Andrew, welcome back. Good to see you in 2024.
Likewise, Paul.
Now, two topics to talk about here, and one we've already sort of talked about in the last week or so. It came up in one of our legal chats, and that is the Murthy versus Biden, as it originally was, but now Murthy versus Missouri. We'll talk about that shortly. First of all, though, Stanford's virality project, what's that about? This seems like quite a story.
Sure. Well, actually, they're very much linked because the Virality Project features quite significantly in Murthy versus Missouri. So because of the really quite substantial government links, and they're acting essentially as an intermediary between government and big tech. But to start a little bit the story at the start, as is often the best method. The Virality Project is essentially a successor project to something called the Election Integrity Partnership. The Election Integrity Partnership was led, and the Virality Project, by the Stanford Internet Observatory. A lot of the work that they were doing was unearthed through the Twitter files, but one of the most important documents that tells us about their work was actually discovered through something called the House Committee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government. It's obviously in the U.S. Context.
Right now, yeah.
Well, at least in the U.S., they're looking at these kind of things, which is good. We could probably do that. Some of that with Australia and New Zealand as well. Was an email to a gentleman with the name of Graham Brookie, who reads something called the Digital Forensics Research Lab, as part of the Atlantic Council, which is essentially kind of NATO's think tank. His email essentially said to some of the other election integrity partners that they'd just been contacted by the Department of Homeland Security and CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, to set up an election integrity partnership. So this initiative, the EIP, and then later the Virality Project, were initiated essentially by the national security state. And their partners were Stanford, along with this Atlantic Council outfit, something called Graphica, and another university called the University of Washington in the Northwest U.S. So that after doing the Election Integrity Partnership, where there was quite a lot of very direct requests to social media to take down what was considered misinformation, election misinformation, they then, after the presidential elections, turned their sights on so-called anti-vaccine misinformation. But as we discovered in the Twitter files, one of the recommendations they gave to the big tech partners, and they had as partners Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, Pinterest, Medium, WhatsApp, Google, YouTube, etc., was that they should consider true stories of vaccine side effects as misinformation.
Yeah.
So this is a kind of how crazy and upside down this world has gone, is that, you know, in this case, true stories were considered misinformation because essentially they went against the narrative that the government was trying to push. And, you know, one of the story that I just did essentially looked through their internal content flagging system, which this House committee released last November, to see, you know, had they really pushed to censor people who had vaccine injury, and this is, you know, essentially that they certainly had. So Virality Project, and I could talk about those as well, so the Virality Project is part of the evidence that is submitted by the plaintiffs in Murthy versus Missouri in terms of showing the coordination between government and big tech extensively, well, for a whole variety of reasons, but the kind of biggest is that, you know, the Department of Homeland Security requested or approached these partners, these proxies that essentially launder the censorship, to create this initiative from the very beginning. This, of course, is not declared in any of these organizations' websites and any documentation on this initiative.
A couple of questions then. Number one, so they wouldn't do that themselves. They like to kind of outsource, because they'd have the capability.
Well, First Amendment says that they're not allowed to. So
this is why they're going to these institutions.
So these essentially function as kind of proxies and intermediaries to launder government censorship. So there are, you know, more protections in the US than we have in Australia and New Zealand around free speech. And so the government cannot be seen to be.
So these are workarounds, the issues that restrict them. The other thing is, if they were declaring truth as misinformation, in their earlier iteration as the election integrity kind of setup, were they doing the same?
Yes. Well, there's not explicit things, but essentially there's a whole number of different things that they, content that they flagged, which included, again, things like jokes, you know, commentary, opinion that was easily within the realm of kind of conversations that anyone would have down the pub or at a in Parliament or wherever it might be. There isn't, from what I've seen, explicit kind of consider true things misinformation like there is in the Plurality Project, but it's sensibly operated in that way. And that in the Election Integrity Partnership, there's much more explicit kind of, we recommend you take this down, we recommend you label this, we recommend you do X, Y, and Z. So, of course, I mean, the Virality Project as this kind of NGO academic consortium didn't have teeth to say, you must take this down, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, it was obvious, I think, to the big tech partners that they had some links to the federal government. And when they were suggesting things, they weren't just serving suggestions, so to speak. Actually,
They're being lent on.
Well, I wouldn't say they were being heavy from the Virality Project or the Election Integrity Partnership. They were being suggested, but with a kind of big stick in the background, which is the kind of backing of the federal government.
Well, some of those businesses also have other associations with the federal government, don't they? In other tech projects,
Graphica, one of the in terms of big tech. Absolutely. They're obviously, well, and this is some of the evidence that was given in the Murphy versus Missouri case on Monday. So I was in Washington, D.C. and sat inside the court. So, which is very interesting, very Romanesque, incredible 20-foot velvet red curtains, et cetera. Felt like I was back 2,000 years ago.
The life of Brian.
There was definitely some element of that. Actually, it's probably the most accurate thing, that analogy. In fact, now I've lost my train of thought.
No, I was going to ask you just quickly before we get on to you being in the room, because that's going to be fascinating. Mm-hmm. In terms of what was labeled as mis and disinformation, what part of the state was, you know, wanting that, and how come there seems to be a commonality of having a partisan kind of attitude to politics and reinforcing one particular side, I'm guessing, in that election sort of integrity stuff. But that then morphed into trying to minimize any, I guess, vaccine hesitancy, anything that might stop people from taking this vaccine. What's the common link?
Well, that's what people are often actually asking. Like, why are elections and vaccines sometimes appear together? I think they would give the answer, which is that they are particularly at risk of large-scale misinformation. But I would say I think it's because of the their kind of political importance, and that because they are popular and very important issues, and so that people do tend to have a lot of conversation around them, and so there that they want to control that conversation, essentially, ensure that it swings in their direction.
So do you think, at the time, I guess that around that election, it's not clear, but following that election, does this side with the Biden administration?
Oh, I mean, the Election Integrity Partnership absolutely sides with the Biden administration in terms of the content that they were focusing on was very much kind of conservative, on the right, et cetera. So, no, very much so. And actually, the head of CISA, a guy called Chris Krebs, actually was fired by Trump soon after the election, I think, because of his dissatisfaction or the kind of what was then later understood as to the role that they were playing. So essentially, I mean, this is part of the conversation that is happening now, which is that this kind of administrative state, the bureaucracy, is very much tilted in one political direction, and essentially being weaponized. Hence, this kind of House Committee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government, for one party over the other party, rather than being, neutral as is their remit.
Well, that sounds dangerous. I take it people making decisions on, vaccine-related content on social media were not medical professionals necessarily, right?
To our understanding, or my understanding, no, none of them were medical professionals. Not that I've seen. So they did have some partnerships. So they had partnerships with the Office of the Surgeon General, who came and kind of spoke at the Sanford Internet Observatory. But mostly, as to my knowledge, the people who were kind of going through these tickets were often kind of students and interns and stuff, and not particularly with massive amounts of medical knowledge. And they often sought to contradict the deliberations or the decisions of professional medical practitioners and override them, essentially.
They weren't targeting necessarily the heavy hitters. This could be anyone commenting, right? It could be
these were tiny things. So one example that I gave in that story was a girl called Maddie DeGarry. She was in a Pfizer. Her parents enrolled her in a Pfizer vaccine trial for children, so not a very anti-vax thing to do. So, I mean, and they went and then logged a huge amount of documentation about this story because she claimed that she was injured, and there was documents that had like 2 likes and 2 shares, like, almost nothing, almost no engagement. And they claimed that this story that she was vaccine injured was false, because they said the dates didn't line up with the Moderna trial, but all the documentation they created said that she was in the Pfizer trial, and she was in the Pfizer trial. They couldn't even get the absolute basics right as they were trying to apparently adjudicate the truth. I saw documents from Maddie's mother that showed that the emergency doctor, because straight after the second shot, she basically fell ill, was, when she was discharged from the emergency room, the discharge documentation says, vaccine injury on it. And there are other multiple doctors that are kind of documentation that I cited that also said the same thing. So I can't tell you exactly for sure that she was vaccine injured, but I can tell you that the people at the Virality Project didn't check this, and that they didn't have the medical knowledge or any knowledge really to contradict what actual medical professionals had said, but they saw fit to say, well, this is false, and, to suggest to social media companies that it shouldn't be allowed on their platforms.
So they're not really interested in the truth of something. It's how to spin the narrative.
They're interested in the narrative, and they often say that out very much out loud. So this is the problem with this whole framework around mis and disinformation, malinformation, is that one, it assumes that authorities have, the sole access to the truth, and it also suggests that they're completely infallible as regards their exercising their duties, which I think we've seen over the course of many years, over history entirely, you could say, that people in authority sometimes get it right, and they quite often also get it wrong. And that's why we have citizens there to hold them accountable.
Yeah, the interesting thing is, and I'm sure you're aware of this, that's the United States experience there. But we had something similar here. Social media accounts were being trolled through, and to the same kind of resolution, everyday people making comments, they were being scraped out as well. So, okay, different entities in different countries, but a lockstep approach. It's the same approach.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, I haven't looked much at the New Zealand situation, but I would be guessing that you are quite right, and it would reflect the rest of the world. I did an Australian Twitter files that showed that the Department of Home Affairs, which essentially is also our kind of military kind of intelligence and policing arm of the Australian government, border force, our intelligence agencies, etc., were policing COVID-related content as part of what they called the extremism division. So what was an arm that was meant to look at, say, you know, terrorism or other sorts of activities, was policing jokes, different opinions, criticism of politicians, tiny accounts, you know, this account that they had flagged that had 20 followers. And it's just like, what are you doing? I mean, this is what we're paying our taxes so that you can, like, follow around people with 20 followers on the internet. They were flagging content that wasn't even from Australians, with the idea that somehow they had jurisdiction over what someone in the US or
well, there's an outsourcing effect, isn't there? If you can't spy on your own people, you can outsource to one of the Five Eyes, give them a bit of software, and they're away.
Absolutely. That is definitely one of the tactics that with the Five Eyes, these kind of Australia, New Zealand, Canada, US, UK, is that kind of help each other out by doing the domestic spy. Another country would do the domestic spying for them that they are not able to do.
Yeah, and everyone's got plausible deniability and so on and so forth. Yeah. Okay, so take us then inside the Supreme Court, and I'm curious to hear what you think about some of the Trump choices, nominations, candidates who have now, I think, Amy Comey Barrett and Kavanaugh, two of them. Is that going to, you'll tell us what this is all about, but is that going to, because it's a fundamental First Amendment proposition, isn't it? Is that going to have an effect?
Well, I mean, yeah, some of the Kavanaugh and Comey Barrett were actually not, they were in the middle, actually, on this stuff. They weren't mostly the Democrat appointed ones were very much not convinced by a lot of the arguments. And in fact, one, Justice Jackson, I mean, she actually went completely outside the Overton window of the First Amendment and said the First Amendment was hamstringing government. I mean, she has to put her hand up and swear an oath to protect the Constitution. And she's actually was saying that she thought that the First Amendment was hamstringing the conversation in terms of, you know, essentially being able to keep people safe and secure. But that's actually, the First Amendment is meant to hamstring the government and to make the government accountable to the people. Otherwise, essentially, you have a tyranny. You just have the government doing whatever it wants because it says so. So, I mean, again, my background is completely from the kind of left progressive world. So this is absolutely upside down as far as I'm concerned, that the kind of right-wing judges, you know, like Scalito and Thomas and others, they were the ones who were sticking up for the First Amendment and for free speech. And it was the Democrat ones who were expressing skepticism or even as not just about the case, in one case, the one I just mentioned, Justice Jackson, you know, expressing skepticism full stop about free speech, the First Amendment more broadly. And I guess this echoes a kind of shift amongst liberals. It's really a turn against free speech. In fact, you know, there's been an article in the New York Times that was published just before the case that essentially was like, you know, do we need, you know, expressing deep skepticism of free speech. One, a big one in the Globe and Mail, that is like, you know, all this free speech is giving us more Trumps. We have to stop it. And even the New York Times, I think it was yesterday or the day before, published a story celebrating the deep state, you know, something along the lines of, you know,
well,
why
that
the deep
wasn't
state
supposed to
awesome.
Exist not too long ago, Andrew. The deep state.
Well, so this, I mean, absolutely. So this is actually quite interesting that they feel they've had to, whereas, you know, up until quite recently, a lot of people were arguing that, no, the government is not getting involved in social media content moderation. They're not kind of putting their fingers in there and et cetera, et cetera. Now they've gone, oh, yes, they are, and it's a good thing, right? So in some ways they've had to admit that this meddling is happening. And now they have to say, well, actually, there is meddling and it's a good thing. And now they are also saying, yes, there is a deep state and it's awesome. So this in some ways I would say is a victory, because they can no longer deny what I think a lot of people have seen for quite some time. Now they just have to kind of sell this new package. I'm hoping a lot of people are not going
fancy trying to sell that. Who would have ever thought that that there'd be an attempt even to sell that as something that could fly? Maybe it can.
By liberals. Whereas you can imagine, I could almost imagine kind of neocons, you know, around the Iraq war or something, selling this. But, you know, I could never imagine kind of liberals and progressives going, oh, yes, this is really great. Unelected government officials deciding.
Sign me
what's
up.
True and false. Yeah.
One thing I have read is that, that aside, comparisons were made between, you know, what was done on social media and, you know, the normal course of communications and the ebb and flow between, you know, the bigger media entities like cable news channels and, you know, big newspapers. Mm-hmm. And they're saying that the government always needs to be able to be in a position to communicate with these entities, because a lot of this information is, you know, has huge consequences if it's wrong or gets out of hand. But how can you make that equivalent? Because you're talking about two different things, right?
Oh, no, absolutely, I would say, because in the case of, you know, a government official calling out the Washington Post and the New York Times or whoever and saying, we didn't like your story, or you got this part of the story wrong, or et cetera, sure, you can do that. You can't say, don't publish this. I mean, I think there are a few little exceptions around national security, and obviously those can also potentially be abused. But here they're not talking to the person who published the content. They're talking to the platform that is hosting the content and saying, take this content down. So it's certainly not the same thing. You're abridging the speech of other people, and it's not being done in a way that is just kind of commenting on, and this would be the government's argument, or what the government lawyer was kind of arguing. It's not just, you know, we're just commenting or expressing displeasure, et cetera, et cetera. It's really quite explicit kind of pushing for, and it comes with the full force of the state. It's one thing for a newspaper to criticize social media and the misinformation that might be circulating on it. That newspaper has no power over those social media companies, or very little other than reputation damage. When you are the government, when you have control over antitrust or you know, regulation, etc., then your comments come with a big stick.
Yeah, the biggest stick.
There is.
I believe caught up in that was the censoring, and I think I saw on Rogan's podcast. The chap from Zuckerberg from Facebook saying that, you know, the FBI kind of told them that this was Russian disinformation. It turned out, though, that I think a majority of voters in America post the election said they would have voted differently if they'd understood what the Hunter laptop story was about. So that was an epic interference in an election. That's as bad as it gets, isn't it? Are they considering that as part of this?
No, so that's not in the case, because the case mostly relates to around COVID. But, I mean, just to add to the Hunter Biden kind of laptop scenario, which, again, turned out to be true, I mean, 2 months before that laptop was released publicly, the Aspen Institute was essentially kind of Democrat-aligned mega think tank with, you know, tens of millions of dollars of budget each year, hosted a tabletop exercise with the New York Times, Twitter, Facebook, the Washington Post, CNN, Rolling Stone, a variety of different academics, some so-called anti-disinformation NGOs, on the topic of a Hunter Biden hack and leak laptop focused on Ukraine's Burisma energy company.
Oh, dear.
2 months before it. This is in the Twitter file. So this is 2 months before this laptop is known to anyone other than.
So they were all ready to go with this. They were coiled springs.
They were all ready to go.
Mapped it all out.
Wow. They did an exercise. The only people who knew at that time were the New York Post, who had the laptop, the Trump campaign team, or sections of it, and the FBI, and perhaps you might imagine other sections of US intelligence. And somehow the Aspen Institute makes a very, very good guess that this laptop that happens to be a real laptop later is coming down the pipeline, and they get all of the biggest players in the media and big tech, et cetera, together essentially to practice. So if you search this, you know, Hunter Biden laptop Twitter files, you'll find reporting from Michael Schellenberger with all the internal documents that were found inside the Twitter files, where they essentially game plan each day of how they're going to respond to this laptop as it arrives. I mean, and again, one of the participating organizations, something called First Draft, is one of the leading so-called anti-disinformation NGOs. It came up with this rubric of misdis and malinformation. And so the people who are claiming to be anti-disinformation are actually running disinformation campaigns.
Wow. The name of the case has changed. Why is that?
As I understand it, because when it got to the Supreme Court, the order of the plaintiffs kind of swapped around, and Murphy is named first as opposed to Biden. Murphy was the Surgeon General,
right,
of the United States. He may well still be. And Missouri is the state. So the states of Missouri and Louisiana are also acting on behalf of their citizens. So the Attorney General there have taken up this case.
Well, I suppose that's reassuring that they've done that.
Yes.
Some
And there are kind of states who are, I mean, you could never imagine this. Oh, I can't in Australia. I'm mapping across New Zealand as well, that a kind of state is like, well, we're going to challenge it in the federal court, you know, what the federal government has been doing and how it's been censoring our citizens. So, you know, as much as people fear the decline of democracy in the US, and I think there's some pretty big issues, to say the least, there is also some pretty kind of robust systems in there that we don't always have.
Is it possible, what are people saying, that the Supreme Court might go against the First Amendment? Is that possible?
Well, I don't know that they'd go against the First Amendment, but they might not see that this case meets the standard.
But it must
have. Some question. I mean, I think for a lot of people, it's quite obvious, and it must do. Unfortunately, the lawyer, as a result of some, the lead lawyer, as a result of some politicking, did not argue the case, and they had a new lawyer who did not do as good a job. And so, you know, it was a bit of a fine line, essentially, but, you know, where it was going to land, at least based on the oral arguments. Of course, they've submitted hundreds and hundreds of pages each of written briefs in there as well. So it's not the be-all and end-all, those oral arguments. But, you know, the Aaron Cariotti, who's was a professor of psychiatry at the University of California, and is one of the plaintiffs, when I spoke to him afterwards, he thought essentially they might water the injunction down, because at the moment the case actually continues after this. The hearing here was actually just about injunctions that had been set in place to stop immediately, whilst the rest of the trial was being heard, government contacting social media to encouraged them to take down First Amendment protected speech. So the trial continues regardless of this decision one way or the other. That said, a loss here is still not good. But his theory was that they will kind of water it down till they get to a 5-4 decision. And instead of, you know, them, the court having an injunction on 20 different, you know, agencies from contacting social media, it would just be 3 or 4. So that we will know around the end of June, apparently.
Interesting times.
It is too interesting.
Yeah, and part of that decision, part of that case, what, a couple of weeks away? Is that the
anticipation? End of June. End of June.
Right, yeah. All right, Andy, have we left anything out? Is there anything more that we need to know about those intertwined?
I mean, there's a lot, but I think for now that's probably already loaded your audience up with far too much information. So, but I think the rubric, although not the rubric, the shorthand essentially is the government has been laundering its free speech requests through these kind of academic and NGO proxies and has been, you know, meddling quite substantially. You know, whether or not the kind of proxying and laundering through those third parties is essentially helping them to get away with it is what we will see, by the end of June. Hopefully they put a stop to it.
The ends justify the means, or the means justify the ends, whatever it seems.
I'm sure they'll come up with one reason or another.
Andrew Lowenthal, thank you for coming back on RCR, and I look forward to talking again.
Thanks, Paul.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.